eat.
Oh, so good.
Drink. Talk. Rick Redding and Steve Coombs serve up savory conversations about Louisville's world-famous restaurant food and drink scene. The wine is uncorked, the bourbon neat, the apps are on the table. Here comes the main course.
Well, welcome back to Eat, Drink, Talk, where every week we serve up the latest in Louisville restaurant dining and drinking news. I'm Steve Coombs, and I've got my co-host Rick Redding here. How are you, Rick?
Doing great, and looking forward to talking about more stuff to eat, stuff to drink, stuff to talk about.
That's a beautiful thing, is it not?
Well, we had a lot of fun this week, so you know,
a lot of calories.
My diet's not doing well, but I did have a lot of fun. So that's what really counts in terms of this show.
We did. We had a little bit of fun last night out at Third Term Brewing in J-Town. It was an unrelated event, but you know, there was eating and drinking of really good beer and.
Right, it's
barbecue.
My event, Cocktails with Champions. I love
right.
I love the fact that I like thought this up because I thought it was a cool name. And from that, we created this event and got Ballantine involved, Ballantine Whiskey involved. And we had 120 or
was it that many?
120
awesome.
Folks out there.
It was a great time.
Ran out of bourbon ball slushies like in the first half hour. So, you know, that was popular too.
Absolutely. Those are great whiskeys. I mean, they're fun to flavor with. They're fun to cook with. They're fun to, you know, I like the chocolate one, to just a little bit of it to put it in a Manhattan. It gives the bourbon real depth. So remember that, folks, when you're making your Manhattan at home. Give it a little splash of Ballantine chocolate whiskey.
Wait till you hear what I Paul Toole, the founder of Ballantine, is on the show this week. He's my guest on the interview segment, and he talked to me about how do you think this is weird, Steve? The big whiskey companies, the Jim Beams of the world, all those guys, they've got into the flavored whiskeys. They got honey flavored, cinnamon flavored, all this stuff.
Right.
Thus far, Ballantine is like the only chocolate one
that I'm aware of.
That a guy who would know, Paul, is aware of too.
Right.
So
right.
He wanted me to not tell them about chocolate flavor.
Those big guys. Well, you know, the one thing that seems to startle a lot of people is that flavored whiskey segment is the fastest growing segment in whiskey overall. So
right.
I think Paul wisely is into a good niche. So
yeah, and he talks when we get into it, he talks a little bit about the you know, the allure of chocolate and what a dazzling flavor it is for all the reasons of I guess romance and all the endorphins that it releases.
That's right. And it's just good. That's all I'm going with. It's just fantastic. How do you not like chocolate? And it's funny too that you interviewed a spirits professional, as did I. I interviewed this week Drew Colesveen, who is the master distiller at Willett Distillery in Bardstown, which is a fantastic high-end whiskey maker. And I went down there just to talk to him about, you know, what's new at Willett. Yet he took me around to see the entire place where I'm jokingly calling it Willett World. They are building a 20,000 square foot manor home there that has a six bedroom B&B, and they're building a grist mill that, of course, they're going to call Noah's Mill because that's one of their brands. But they'll grind all their own grain there, which is fantastic. They're doing a brand new visitor center, which will be big. We'll have a restaurant. We'll have a cocktail bar. And it's just fantastic what they're doing.
It's amazing. I'm kind of jealous you get to go on these writer trips that and explore all these things. But it really reminds me of a lot of what they're doing. We talked about last week at Castle and Key, you know, building this great thing for visitors to come to and produce the product.
A total experience. It's not just a place to pick up booze, souvenirs, ball caps, shot glasses, things like that. That they really want you to come there and enjoy the entire thing. And in the case of Willett, I don't know that anybody has a place where you can stay the night on campus at a Kentucky distillery.
I don't think that's part of the deal at Castle and Key. And it's really cool because that is the whole thing about the bourbon tourism thing, I think, that people are starting to get, and people come in from all over the country. In fact, at my house, I have an Airbnb guest this weekend who's coming in just to spend the weekend traveling around on the bourbon trail.
No kidding.
No kidding.
How cool. Fantastic.
At the Cozy Cottage in J-Town.
Okay. Well, you know, speaking of news this week.
Let's talk about news. That's what Eat, Drink, Talk is going to be all about. And I think we should tell our listeners just how much how great, you know, with our backgrounds as journalists and reporters and our fun personalities, right? We're going
to what our spouses and girlfriends say. Yeah.
That's right. We're gonna have access to a lot of the people who are making news, and hopefully we'll report it either here or on eatdrinktalk.net, the website, first.
That's right. A little bit more in depth sometimes, too. Of course, this week's big news that everybody seems to be talking about is the pending closure of the Bristol Bar and Grill out in Prospect on May 29th. And did that shock you when you heard that?
Well, you just shake your head when a place that seems to be successful quits operating. So I know you know a lot more about it than I do, but it seems like, it's in a shopping center with a Kroger, and it seems like the story I read was that Kroger didn't want to renew the lease.
Absolutely would not return their calls, emails, anybody. There were two other companies involved, one that does new leases and renews old leases, and nobody, clearly probably from on high from Kroger, would even return their calls.
Wow.
So it's a strange thing because according to the Bristol, they had always paid the rent. In fact, it was automatically drafted, so there was no issue there. That's a good tenant. That doesn't happen very often.
Well, do you think that – does that mean Kroger has something else in mind for the space?
Oh, doubtless. I mean, they own the space, so it's their goal to generate revenue from that.
It's going to be hard to find another restaurant that would be as good a tenant as the Bristol, right?
That's not necessarily true, but, I mean, when you're a landlord – a good tenant is a good tenant. I mean, mm-hmm. as long as they're not destroying the space and they're paying their rent, they're generally pretty darn happy, especially when you're filling. Yeah, I think the Bristol probably had at least 100 parking spots, people who would come in, have their meal, and then go, hey, there's Kroger over there. I'm going to go grab something on the way home. Kroger liquor store right there, same thing.
Yeah.
So it's confusing, to say the least, that they wanted to heave them out. We've also heard a lot of off-the-record discussion that people were asking Bristol, well, will you leave the equipment behind? Which, you know, obviously implies that another restaurant's going to go in there.
Mm-hmm.
Again, but why do you kick out a restaurant icon in Louisville like the Bristol Bar and Grill when, again, all appeared to be well from Kroger's perspective?
Okay, well, I know that you're not going to say on the air, but I know you know an insider tip that it'll be up here first on Intrigue Talk, who that potential tenant it might be.
I have it from a good source, and to be honest with you, I'm surprised at who that might be because it's nowhere near the icon that Bristol is, and knowing that, it makes me wonder if there was an axe to grind somewhere mm-hmm. between Kroger and Hip Enterprises. Hip Enterprises built that center years ago, ran it, leased it the whole bit, and eventually sold it to Kroger. Hip Enterprises also owned. Was the leasor of the space where the Bristol was, and they subcontracted the Bristol to run that operation. It's just interesting to me that they would do that. It doesn't seem to be directly aimed at Kroger rather than possibly at Hip Enterprises, and that's just suspicion, just my hunch.
Well, in summary, if you want your green chili wontons in Prospect, you better hurry, right?
May 29 is the last time to get your green chili wontons in Prospect, at least authentic ones anyway. I'm sure there's some fake ones around.
Well, let's move on. Let's talk about another thing I happened to walk by and thought was newsworthy, and it's chicken.
Chicken.
Okay. I was in Stony Brook, had a meal at the Buffalo Wild Wings over there, and right next door, right there in the shopping center, there's a sign that says Caroli's Rotisserie Chicken opening soon. We're hiring. And, so I looked it up on the internet, found only that the name was registered, but nothing else about it.
Right.
So, Steve, why would a rotisserie chicken store open up next to a chicken wing store?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of answers. The first one is a little bit of a forehead slapper for me that Buffalo Wild Wings would not have said in their lease, no chicken near us. Mm-hmm. You know, they have the muscle to be able to do that. And then the landlord says, hey, got a chicken client for you. Granted, wings and rotisserie are completely different animals in terms of what shows up on the plate. But
they're the same animal.
Well, yeah, that's why I specified what shows up on the plate. Once it's cut apart, it's a totally different thing. Yeah, you busted me on that one. A rotisserie chicken is something I guess you could take home. And like you and I were talking about, rotisserie chicken is – it's kind of a very 90s thing. It's a great product, but Costco and Kroger and everybody else seems to have it mastered. So why is this guy going to come into what surely is pricey real estate next to an extremely busy restaurant and do it? I don't know.
Well, we'll find out. It used to be a Two Hans Mongolian Grill, which was there for a little while, because I can remember in like 1996 or 97 doing a story for Business First about the place.
On so, that one there or
yeah,
another one?
Exactly. That, wow. That exact one. So
I'll be done.
Interesting. Yeah. What else is up?
Well, we were looking, you and I both were talking about the dinner at Buck's next week. That's
can't
a
wait.
Ballotin paired dinner. And you and I haven't talked about this, though. When I was a critic for Louisville Magazine, I was sent to go review Buck's. This is about 8-9 years ago. And the meal was so bad that I called the editor and said, we'll just skip this one. The place is just not doing well. The food was off, badly off.
Which is pretty extreme, because I know that that's probably the only time you ever did that.
No, there's a couple more.
Okay.
And some of those restaurants are still operating,
too. Damn critic.
But the thing about it was, Buck's is sold. They've got newish owners, I guess, about 4 or 5 years ago. And the new chef, I believe it's Kyle Hubbish is his name, has really, really turned the place around, at least on the menu side of it. I had dinner there about 2 months ago and was really impressed. And so I'm pretty excited about this dinner to see what he's going to do. Have you gotten to eat there since he's been there?
Well, I don't think so. What I know about Buck's is white flowers and, this great atmosphere. But,
beautiful,
as far as the food,
it's
probably been 5 years since I've been in there.
So I would love to see this place bounce back and it be credited to this kid's food, because we were really pleased with it when we last were down there.
All right. So there's a recommendation. We're going to have fun. I think they still have tickets, Steve, if you want to get through, call up Buck's Tuesday night. It's a special dinner. There's some pairings with Ballotin whiskey.
$65 a person? Yeah. For that kind of a dinner, I think it's a good price. Tax and gratuity not included, by the way.
And you get to dine with us.
So,
right.
All right, last thing before we go to our interviews of our fantastic subjects this week. Rick, what's the best drink that you've had this week?
Well, without a doubt, I don't have a good answer for this most weeks, but last night I had the Bourbon Ball Slushy at the Third Turn. And it was really special. I was there as Paul Toole and Greg Hayden, the owner there, sort of came up with the recipe and did the idea. They did a lot of testing on
it. So you were testing?
I didn't get involved in the testing. I just said, when I show up, I want to have one. And really surprisingly, it tasted a little bit like a White Russian, believe it or not.
Oh, I bet.
It was really good. And, Paul in our interview kind of makes fun of me of talking about the ingredients, because I'm not an expert, but I know what I like, and that's what I had this week.
Well, how about you? My favorite thing was also last night. I had the Four Pepper Saison at Third Turn, and that's one of their house beers. It's a sessionable beer, so it's pretty low in alcohol. It was just very light, easy one to sit there and drink while you're just talking to somebody.
With the name Pepper, it sounds like it might be spicy or something.
Wasn't in the least. So that was kind of interesting. But step away from the name, and I enjoyed the beer a lot.
Okay.
All right. What about your best bite real fast?
Best bite. Best thing I had to eat. I didn't need to eat out much. But the other day I stopped in at Mellow Mushroom right here in St. Matthews.
That's right.
Believe it or not, they do have some good food there. And the bartender, Joe, talked me into trying the mushroom soup, which I believe it's the first time in my life I've ever ordered
mushroom soup. I bet, because you're not much of a vegetable guy, right?
Well, I like vegetables, but
not fungi.
It didn't have fries with it, so
But you liked it.
I liked it.
And mine's a little bit of a preview. I went to the press opening or the press luncheon today for Nooshnosh, which is a new Chariot's new restaurant to come on the 23rd, and they had a Blanco pizza, which is basically white sauce with ricotta cheese and shaved Italian ham. It was just freaking fantastic. That's going to be a great restaurant.
I think it is. And I think you want to say something about, people's behavior at soft openings like that. When a restaurateur is just getting ready to open, he's not 100% ready. You're lucky you get an invite to that thing.
Absolutely.
And, and some people don't, I think you think their behavior or their reports on it are misshapen.
Some are sometimes. I think that people go into these things expecting a real live dinner experience without the flaws, that the food will come on time, that the servers will know everything. And it is practice. It's different. I mean, 10 years ago, they weren't doing this in my business. Now they've figured out that it's a good way to let the staff get warmed up before they start charging.
The point is, if you're lucky enough to get invited to one of those things, don't be a critic when you understand that they're just practicing.
Exactly. Right? Be patient and tip. A lot of people come into those things and think, well, it's a zero on my bill. I guess I don't have to tip. No. What they do is they run the ticket and it has all the prices on there, the things that they would have charged you had it been a real meal, and you tip on that. And, of course, you can't get your alcohol free. People complain about that. But the government is a little hard-nosed about giving away booze. So they can't do that either. I'm just saying, when you get invited to these things, be patient, be very friendly, give them feedback because that's what they want.
Right.
And if you can bear it, don't put stuff on social media. Again, wait till the really beautiful finished product is out there.
Well, good message and good point and kind of thing that we want people that listen to the show to take our advice or at least understand the proper way to do things like attending a soft opening.
Absolutely.
Head coach of the Western Kentucky Hilltoppers, Jeff Rom. Today I'm with Matt Jones, Kevin Harned, Pat Forty.
But I'm with Anoush Sheriott,
Kristen Wall,
United States Congressman John Yarmuth,
Sarah Brofancher, and Susie Eastman. I have Kristen Boone,
one of St. Matthew's most favorite sons, Danny Flanagan.
It's Pat Day.
The list goes on and on. The most interesting people in the Ville are on the Rusty Satellite Show with Rick Redding. New episodes Thursdays on Louisville.am.
So we have spent the last half an hour walking around, and you showing me things that are going to answer this question already. But for listeners, tell me what's new at Willett.
So we've got a lot of new things in the works that will be ready hopefully this fall. We're adding on to our visitor center, a couple of new tasting rooms, and we need the space desperately. We're putting in a full open kitchen and full service bar.
And they're looking for a chef, people.
Yes, we are. We're looking for people to help us make the experience better. We're building a bed and breakfast, which will be open this fall as well. It's a 5-bedroom guest house overlooking our water source and probably the most beautiful view of our property that you'll see.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you can see our next door neighbors, Heaven Hill. And we've got a rotunda and a grist mill that'll be functional as well. So
tied into the Noah's Mill name. Yeah.
Exactly. So, it doesn't really have a whole lot to do with bourbon other than making the experience better.
Which is, like we were talking about, the kind of a Napa Valley way to address it, right? I mean, Kentucky's decades behind in that.
Absolutely. And I'm a big proponent of that. I love what they're doing out in Napa. We spend quite a bit of time out there. I think that's really what this area is lacking. It's a very small community of about 12,000 people here in Bardstown, and people want the experience, and we're going to try to give it to them.
That's amazing. So let's talk a little bit about the distillate. I mean, you guys began distilling here in 2012, and just to talk a little bit about the still outside of Woodford, is there another significant pot still in the state?
Yeah, I mean, there's a few. You see the ones over at Alltech.
That's right.
Using.
Yeah. Sorry, Pierce. Yep. Forgot about him.
And we do things the very traditional way of using a stripping column and then doubling in a pot still. But the shape of the still that we're using is quite a bit unique. We actually have a patent on the design. I feel like I can get away with murder because there's so much tunability to it. And really, distillation is the ability to separate, and the greater the ability that you are to keep what you want and dispose of what you don't want, is the whole goal of having a still like what we have.
Where's the art in that? Is it on the moving from hearts to tails? I mean, because I know there's a little bit left over in there that you want. Certainly you don't want any of the heads, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So the heads typically get taken off of the first distillation and the stripping still. And then,
so that's done because you've already got, you said 120 proof alcohol coming to the pot.
Right.
Still.
So those are kind of vented off. And then the tails, actually, we pull those off constantly because we run continuous now instead of starting and stopping every day. But the tails are pulled off the bottom of the pot still doubler, and they go back into the beer well to get redistilled through the entire system. And, depending on the level that you run the pot's still at, it can greatly affect the flavor. So, you know, it's just a lot of playing around and then opening and closing trays. It's been a fun learning experience, to say the least.
That's awesome. So now, compared to your neighbor in Loretto and Claremont, you guys are producing, how many barrels a day would we say?
It's about 50 barrels
about
a day.
About 50 a day. And so Beam is probably doing 800, 900 a day?
At each plant, yes. At their Booker No plant and at their Claremont plant. So
that's amazing.
I think they're in competition with each other, too, which is great.
So I've had the rye, or the two-year rye. I still need to have the three at some point. And I understand now that the bourbon is finally out. It's your first one that was distilled in 2012, right?
That's correct. To commemorate the opening of the distillery back in 1937, March 17th, we decided to release a couple of barrels of our own bourbon that we produced here 4 years ago. And you know, I'm very excited for people to be able to try them, because we've been patiently waiting to release them. And it was wasn't really a last minute decision, but it was something that we didn't really discuss into detail. And you know, I went in and pulled from two production dates. Both of them were for on the bottom floor, and right down the same rick, right next to each other. We didn't have a whole lot to choose from, because, you know, when we started up, we had some technical issues with some pumps and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're down for a few weeks, and, you know, I think I maybe had 150 barrels or something like that to work with. So we didn't really have everything dialed in, and like we do now. But you know, I'm very, very pleased with the way that they've been maturing.
How would you describe this? I mean, is it strong on caramel, big on vanilla? I mean, this particular bourbon.
I think the most shocking thing is that there's not like just a blast of corn in your face, which you would expect from a young whiskey. Yeah, I mean, it's usually very grain forward, and you don't really get that with our young bourbon. And then also the palate, it's very soft and it's very mouth-coating mouth. It's very rich on the palate in terms of the weight. It does need more time, I think, personally, to mature, you know, but it's just showing people what's to come down the pike.
Oh, that's awesome. How many bottles did you guys get out?
I think there were 800-something bottles out of the four barrels. So we split that up.
Not much angels here.
Yeah.
It's good.
Yeah. Well, on the bottom floor, you're not going to get a whole lot. So, especially at that young age. But, you know, it was kind of a Kentucky-only release. And this fall, we're putting out the old Bardstown Bottled and Bond, which was the original flagship brand to Willett. And we've chosen to go back to the original paper label that they used from the 1950s. We're also doing a 90-proof version. Basically the same whiskey, but to you know, some of the states the taxes are a little bit higher, so they actually double if they're over 100 proof.
Oh my!
California,
what a shame.
Especially so, you know, we're trying to be cognizant of the, you know, the different uses for it, but it's going to be really fun to get that out there. And
you know, I doubt they jack up the taxes on their super high proof, not high proof, but high alcohol reds.
Yeah.
You know, that run 17%.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, discrimination, I say. What for you guys, for the brand, what's driving your consumption? Is it retail sales, or is it coming really from the bar and restaurant scene? I mean, where the connoisseurs really go to find these whiskeys?
You know, I'm not really sure, because we don't study that. You know, we're a little bit of a different bird. I think, you know, people find out naturally about us, because we don't do a whole lot of tastings and we don't do a whole lot of events, but being around for as long as we have, people have discovered us one way or another. And you know, I think a lot of people are curious of what we've been up to for the last, you know, several years, because we've gone through dramatic changes in our company. And you know, we're just excited to show as many different variations of whiskey, you know, to people, and that's what keeps things exciting.
Now, specifically to Willett, I like to drink it neat or on the rocks, but do you see a lot of people using it in cocktails?
I do, and versatility, affordability, accessibility, which unfortunately today we're not as accessible as we were 10 years ago. you know, those are kind of our three, pillars. And the use and of having things at a higher proof gives you a little bit more flexibility in terms of what you want to do with it. People can always add water if it's if it's too high proof, but you know, to make a cocktail, especially you know something that's very booze forward, like a Sazerac or an Old Fashioned, you need something with body. That's what the cocktail is built around. So
agreed. I don't like anything less than 100 in a cocktail, frankly. Yeah. I love it to cut through. Now, your family has an incredible history with the distillery, which people can find on the website, which is KentuckyBourbonWhiskey.com, right?
Yes.
If you click on the Willett story tab, you'll see it. And it's probably 1,500 words long.
It's a piece of work. Pretty extensive. My brother-in-law, Hunter Siobhan, who does our marketing and does a lot of the sales, he's really dedicated a massive amount of time to doing research and digging up things that we had no idea about. So,
well, I didn't know that, and I saw today that there is a Georgiana Coombs tied in there. So I'm family, man.
All right.
Somehow. Does that get me a barrel or something?
I'll give you an empty one.
but it's cool. I mean, you read that kind of stuff, especially if there are Kentuckians listening to this. You tie any research into Bardstown, you're going to start finding some names that you know. Not from the whiskey business necessarily, but from, just this center where so much migration occurred, back in the 1830s? Maybe even earlier.
Yeah. I mean, there were people coming here as early as 1771, I think. So it's a pretty old town, and it's a charming place to live, and I think that's why a lot of these families are still here.
Now, and you had mentioned when we were walking around looking at the new properties for the visitor center and the hotel, that Bardstown really needs this and kind of deserves it to have this, lift its profile. Do you guys have that in mind when you were thinking about it? I mean, that this will help Bardstown overall too.
I mean, this wasn't my vision, it was my father's, which I think it makes a lot of sense.
And for listeners, his name is?
Evan Coolsveen. Okay. And he's been wanting to do this for a long time. It's a small family business. It's difficult to do everything that you want to. And a lot of people don't understand that we don't have any debt other than the monthly bills. We don't borrow money. We don't have any private equity investors. This is something that our existing, independent bottling business built and paid for, the rebuilding of the distillery and all these other projects. So we're very fortunate that, there's been a big boom in bourbon, and it's allowed us to kind of resurrect our company. To the level that it's at now, I think this town is lacking the food and the nightlife scene is very underwhelming here, and I travel the world, I ate some great restaurants, and I can just see, like, if someone would take a chance on this town, that it could turn into not necessarily Napa, but something of that style.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of the bourbon boom, let's talk one last bit about the whiskeys. Will it ever get to the point that it stops sourcing or contract distilling any of its outside booze? Is that your vision?
I don't know. I mean, we really haven't had that discussion. I always think that you don't ever want to rule that out. I look at it, as... kind of having a spice rack to play with, as long as you're upfront about the fact that you're doing it. A lot of the people that we have purchased from in the past have disclosures, and it's just the nature of the business, and we try to honor those. So I think what you're seeing right now is that because of the boom, it's working itself out whether we want it to or not. We always want to keep strong relationships with all of our friends and families that we've been doing business with for a very, very long time. So
and do you have control over that process to be able to say, this is how I want it distilled, this is the yeast I want, the mash bill?
Absolutely not. a sample of a bottle typically shows up, and it's take it or leave it. So
no kidding.
Yeah,
do you like that gamble? Is that fun, or
you know,
is it frightening?
We trust these other companies. Obviously, they've been around for so long, and they make great whiskey. So, we either use it or we let it mature until we're really happy with the way that it tastes.
Well, excellent. I really appreciate
it. It's a very interesting concept, I know, for people to understand, but you know, I think what we've done with the bottlings of the stuff that we've purchased from other people, it's given us a really flexible range and different style of whiskey, style of bourbon. And then, you know, that kind of inspired us when we rebuilt the distillery. We have 6 mash bills, so yeah, it's pretty interesting. And I don't think that we would have done that if we just started up from scratch. We would have just used the original 3 from Willard.
Same yeast for all of them?
Yes, same yeast for all of them.
Do you propagate here on campus?
We do. It's not from a slant. Our original yeast was thrown away after the distillery was shut down, so we use a dry active yeast and make it really happy through propagation and pitch it in the fermenters.
That's what I need to get is some natural sound of the yeast the mash bubbling. Let people know what that sounds like.
Yeah, I equate it to when you see a fermenter, it's like watching the white noise on TV. It just sucks you in.
Drew Colesveen, thanks so much for giving us some time on Eat, Drink, Talk.
Anytime, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, buddy.
Excuse me, garçon. I'll have another.
All right, here we are on Eat, Drink, Talk for the, this is the second interview. Paul Toole of Ballantine Whiskey is with me today, and Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Rick. It's great to be here, and I'm excited to talk about Ballantine to this new audience a little bit. Very exciting for you and Steve Coombs. Congratulations to you both.
Well, thanks a lot. We are very, we're very pumped about doing this and interviewing people in the industry that are making things happen, and you know, it intrigues me, of course, that that you can still in America come up with an idea, say I'm gonna bottle and I'm gonna create a new brand for whiskey in when there's all kinds of whiskey out there, and have something totally unique. Tell me a little bit of the story of how you got started.
Sure. Well, first of all, it is terrific to be able to have that opportunity right here. You know, sort of in the heart of bourbon country and all the great lore that comes along with that to be able to bring a brand to the marketplace. It's a combination of having a pretty good intuition about maybe where the business might have been going a couple of years ago, and that comes from just good it's nature and nurture, so a little bit of good intuition but also a strong background in the discipline of marketing and spirits development through Brown-Forman, many years with Brown-Forman.
It's not like you were an accountant before. you know a little bit about this.
Right, but accountants can have great creative ideas too, Rick. I wouldn't. But yeah, so it's a combination of being around it for many years, seeing the path to the marketplace and having a little bit of awareness of where, consumers are and not just in strictly speaking in the bourbon and the whiskey business, but think about what's happened in the wine business over the last 25 or 30 years, what's happened in the craft beer business over the last 20 or 15 or 10 years, especially as that accelerates, all the excitement and exploration in the culinary world, the access that people now have to really exciting culinary styles, flavors, ingredients, just literal access to really exciting, ingredients that we just didn't have access to 15 years ago. So
do you think it's, are we just drinking more or are our taste getting better? I mean, we're not, I don't drink Bud Light anymore. So, I mean, that's one touchstone of it. But,
right.
What do you think that
is? I don't think strictly speaking quantifiable standpoint, we're drinking more. I think people are drinking maybe a broader portfolio of spirits. I mean, all consumers, drink a pretty wide portfolio of spirits based on not just spirits, but wine and beer, but who they're with, what they're doing, what the occasion is. So, consumers have a good number of alcoholic beverages in their portfolio. Those may be getting a little broader, and I think I think it's a really good question, though, and I think it gets to the business question of, and specifically sort of in the area that I'm competing, is this proliferation of craft, and specifically craft bourbon and whiskeys, is that making the pie bigger, or, are we all sort of taking share from each other?
Sure.
And I think a big consideration for some of the big players in the market, like the Brown-Formans and the Diageos, is you know, are us little craft guys additive to the business, or are we just sort of poking around the edges of the really, really big consumer franchises? I don't think we exactly know the answer to that yet, but I do know that those big companies, you know, some like Brown-Forman here, a lot of folks are familiar with, you know, they're really interested in brand development and new craft. They're, you know, bringing new products to the marketplace. They're real exciting. And so I think everybody's, you know, really sees that consumers are interested in exploring and discovering new things. And, you know, the big guys and the little guys are all, you know, working on putting really, you know, really fine quality products into the marketplace.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about Balaton a little bit. Chocolate. Of all the flavors, all the things, you've got four flavors of, four chocolate flavors for your product, the Balaton whiskey. You know, where did that come from? Was there chocolate whiskey before, or not?
No, not that I knew of. And you see a couple of little iterations of you know, different styles of chocolate. I think ours is the most discerning amongst the chocolate expressions. And there's four flavors within that, as you mentioned. There's the original chocolate, the bourbon ball, the caramel turtle, and the chocolate mint. And there's you know, there's a lot of separation between them. So there's a reason for each of those four flavors to be out there, and consumers love them all. But, you know, some consumers, you know, love some more than others. So, I mean, there's a preference in there. But to the point about why chocolate, you know, and I think, you know, distillers and master distillers and folks who are speaking about bourbon very eloquently, very articulately today are talking about all the flavors that are in all that, all the just wonderful magical flavors that the corn and the water and the barrel provide to bourbons and to whiskey. And within those naturally organic, organically occurring flavors, you have chocolate and you have mint and you have caramel and, you know, you have all these exciting flavors that, that we've just simply, you know, drawn those out. We've bringing, you know, greater expression to those flavors that naturally occur in, you know, a glass of really, really nice bourbon or nice whiskey.
Okay. Well, you know, like I know the big brands, you know, the Wild Turkeys of the world and the Jim Beams have, what I've seen, I guess, are honey flavored and cinnamon flavored, but the big guys are haven't yet, and I don't know if that's coming. Come out with a chocolate flavor,
right? Yeah, don't give them any ideas. Thank you, thank you very much, Rick. But well, I mean, on one hand, you know, the sincerest form of flattery is that replication, I guess. You know, I think that the trail has been blazed a little bit with cinnamon, and a couple of the big guys have done a really fine job of delivering that. Same with honey, really, you know, great products that, that consumers love. They're not, they haven't sort of discovered chocolate yet. I might like to keep them at bay a little while. But, you know, chocolate is a flavor that both psychologically and physiologically, and not to get too sciencey, because I can't, but chocolate induces responses in people that's just different than other flavors. A little bit like you know, hot peppers tend to do in terms of endorphin releases and things like that. Some of it again is, you know, psychological association. Some of it's physiological. That dark chocolate that compels your body to release endorphins and things like that. So there's a real sort of visceral base attraction to chocolate, and consumers in the U.S. in particular list chocolate as either their favorite or second favorite flavor. 82% of U.S. consumers list it as number one or number two in their flavor profile of choice. So it's just a very compelling flavor to be out there. And again, it's has its natural associations with bourbon and whiskey in that bourbon flavor wheel that we're using to talk about the intricacies and the nuances of bourbon flavors.
Okay, well, I promise not to give Jim Beam any ideas.
Too late for that, my friend.
But let me ask you about how successful this brand's been. It's only been on the market in terms of months, and I know you're going on a trip today, and you're in a number of different states. Tell me how the branding and the marketing of the product is going.
Yeah, well, it's really going well, and I think more importantly, sort of according to plan, which you know, we'll get knocked off of that plan at some point probably because things happen, but You know, I think the bottom line is we've already shown in a number of markets that we have a really compelling consumer proposition. You know, we don't have a lot of money to spend right now, so it's really sort of a bottle and a drink at a time, which mm-hmm. is, you know, the way brands are honestly built. I mean, it's one interaction at a time, one consumer ordering your product, having a great experience, you know, sharing that with a friend, and then they come back, and that's how you grow the brand. So, you know, in the absence of, you know, big billboards or just a lot of activity in the marketplace, you sell it a bottle and a drink at a time. And I think Ballantine is proving that we have a really, really nice, you know, brand and product proposition. It's a premium product. It tastes great. And, you know, I'll just say, I think in the bourbon industry specifically, in the bourbon category right now, there's a lot of great discovery going on. Consumers are just really excited about the category, and they're buying lots and lots of varieties of bourbon. I think, you know, there'll have to be a shakeout. There always is when a category explodes like that. And I think the brands that will shake out will be brands that, you know, have an honest story, have a great product, and that consumers really enjoy interacting with. And I think consumers, that's a, you know, fancy way of saying consumers like drinking it. Let's just get to that. And consumers really like drinking Ballantine.
Well, I think we got some experience with that last night. Let's talk about the great Cocktails with Champions event. You know, it had over 100 people out here in J-Town to Third Turn Brewing, and gosh, it seems like I don't know how many people were introduced to Ballantine for the first time last night. It seems like quite a few,
and I do want to thank our new good friends here at Third Turn Brewing. It's a great little spot out here in sort of the heart of J-Town, so and they're making really terrific craft beers, and they're very welcoming, so come out and visit those guys. But yeah, no, I think we did introduce a good number of folks to Ballantine, and in a way that was really fun and creative in a bourbon ball slushy. So we, you know,
which sold out.
I mean, it's a little supply chain issue because you got to freeze that stuff a few hours in advance, and they made a tank full, and we sold a tank full in 45 minutes, and we had an hour and a half of the event left. But that's the good news. And then we went on to enjoy it in a variety of different ways. One, and especially in a brew pub like this, one of the great ways to do it is just one of their great craft beers and a shot, you know, sort of a sidecar of Ballantine, and that great sweet and savory combination is really, really good, and people really loved it. I loved it.
Yeah.
Did you like it?
I loved it, too. I did the slushies. They really reminded me of, like, a White Russian in terms of the taste of that slushie. Uh-huh. It had cream to mint in it and cream and...
Cream to cocoa, I think.
Cream to cocoa.
Yeah, it was the bourbon ball size. So it was. It's like a, you know, that consistency of a mudslide or a pina colada, and you know, we'll do a slushy that's more the sort of traditional bourbon slushy with the citrus, the orange juice, the sweet tea, and the lemonade. And this one, on the bourbon ball side, had a little more cream to it. It was great, and like I say, people knocked it out in just a few short minutes, actually. So it was a fun event.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's great. So tell me again how people are discovering it. I mean, it's not everywhere, right?
Well, I mean, in the what we call retail accounts, the liquor stores and things, our great partners at Republic Distributing have done a great job. So, I mean, it's in all of the big liquor stores. So go find your Ballantine there in the whiskey section. And, you know, we're developing our on-premise business, our bar and restaurant business. It's a little longer process just because, they have limited space in a restaurant versus the big expansive space of a liquor store. But, you know, my recommendation is wherever you love to go have a nice cocktail or have a little dinner or drink, you know, ask about Ballantine, and I know they'll be happy to bring it in. So
sure.
I'd appreciate that.
Well, that'd be great. And it's not just in Louisville. It started here, but how many states are you in there?
Yeah, we kicked off Kentucky in November, and then we launched South Carolina shortly after that, Illinois. We're in Nashville, where it's just booming. I mean, it really is on fire in Nashville. We're launching Florida, Arizona, Colorado, Minnesota here in the next 60 days, and Georgia in that as well, if you've got listeners that are sort of passing through on the way home to Georgia or Minnesota or Florida. And then three or four states after that. So we ought to be in 15, I'm going to call it 15 states by early fall, which is when you sort of shut that off and then focus on the holiday season.
Well, it's a great story. Great that it all started right here in Louisville. Thanks for being with us, Paul.
Thank you, Rick.
I
appreciate it.
You just can't get enough. Catch up on the news of the city's restaurant scene every single day by visiting www.eatdrinktalk.net. Steve and Rick share all the latest local scoop from Louisville's restaurants and bars. You can also find old episodes of the show and connect with the guys on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Eat well, my friends. Another episode next week.